For this episode of the podcast, I have my first returning guest, Anthony Tyler. Anthony, of course, wrote the book Dive Manual, Empirical Investigations of Mysticism. I have a link in the show notes where you can purchase that if you're interested. Anthony is a fantastic individual. He's very knowledgeable about actually finding empirical proof for some of the sometimes outlandish things that we discuss about how to tie in the mystical aspect of human nature with the things that we see on an everyday basis. And his book is a prime example of that. I really enjoyed it. Go check out the previous interview. I'll have a link in the show notes for that episode where you can listen as well. But for this one, we go a little deeper. We go a little stranger, maybe. And we dive into the nature of good and evil, at least as it relates mostly to Western culture, because, of course, the large majority of people listening to the podcast are kind of influenced by Western society. So I wanted to tackle this topic because this kind of serves as a bit of an introduction to the idea of good and evil and how we view it as we begin our dive into Zoroastrianism, which, of course, is very much a dualist tradition. And we do mention Zoroastrianism a little bit. I go into the concept of Ahura Mazda in Ahriman in this episode. So that should give you kind of a narrow basis for what the discussion of Zoroastrianism will entail. And that'll be the topic of focus for the next week or so, interspersed with a few other episodes as well. As an added benefit, this discussion kind of went into an interesting discussion of ufology and the state of ufology in modern times as it relates to the idea of the knowledge of good and evil, but also things that are tangentially related to that in terms of manifesting archetypes, egregores, etc. So if you want to check out Anthony and my discussion of modern ufology and how this all ties in together to mysticism, then check out the Patreon. It's going to be available as a bonus episode at any level. Before we get the episode started, of course, you know I have to talk about the Patreon at patreon.com/thealchemicalmind, where for just $1 a month, you can support this podcast and, of course, get additional content, early access to episodes, and best of all, the ad-free feed, so you don't have to listen to spots like this one or the upcoming ad. Join the others who are getting value out of listening to this podcast and supporting the show, like, for example, James, who asked that I plug his awesome band. Check out Zar Bomba on Spotify. There'll be a link in the show notes. And of course, Michael Smith, both of them joining me at the $5 level. And of course, the many others who support podcasts at every other tier, thank you so much for your support. Be sure to check out patreon.com/thealchemicalmind for more information, including all the great tiers available to you. My first returning guest. I'm so excited. Anthony Tyler, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you for having me back on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out, man. It's always fun chatting with you. I know you've made the rounds recently, so it's good to hear your voice on shows that I listen to.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, and it's been great to be on those shows. I'm not trying to stroke anyone's ego too much here, but like the community in general has been really cool. There's a lot of different cool podcasts and researchers and radio hosts out there. And not all of them, but so many of them you can find on Twitter. And so as much as I hate the triviality of Twitter, but it's been cool to connect with people. And I love any opportunity I can get to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I especially like hearing you on AM Byte. I love Miguel. Maybe one day I'll have him on the show as well. But yeah, I've been listening to that show for years. And I know you were recently on doing their live AB sessions, so that's cool.
Yeah, that was my second time on with Miguel, and we did a Halloween special. So if anyone wants to go back into the catalog and check that out, it was about horror and esotericism, among other things. We went into Clive Barker and some other stuff. That was a really fun conversation.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. So, I'm a huge Lovecraft fan, so
likewise.
I love the horror and esoteric connection. It's quite evident, in particular when you're looking at early 20th century, because you have a big spiritualism movement all around the place, and you have things like anthroposophy and theosophy popping up, and Steiner, Gurdjieff, all those people. And I find all that stuff really fascinating. The one issue that I have sometimes, though, is that a lot of that stuff is kind of carried over into modern times, and it seems to have just lost a lot of the, I mean, not to make a pun, but lost a lot of the magic, if you will.
In which way specifically do you mean, with the aesthetics of like the spiritualism with like the seances and ghosts and like that whole resurgence?
Actually wanting to investigate, you know what I mean? This is something that Mike and I have talked about on Mindscape, how, you know, a lot of times when you dive into spiritual topics and philosophy topics, you can get lost a lot in language and symbolism, and you forget that there is like some hidden truth behind the whole thing. And it's a lot more down to earth than it appears. Right. And so people kind of get stuck like finding saviors and talking about angels and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm not saying entities aren't real. I know they're real because I've experienced them. Right. But I think people get a little lost in that stuff and not try to figure out like the meaning behind the things. And there should be a way to like categorically figure this stuff out. And that's something that you talk about in your book, Dive Manual. But it's something that I've always wondered, and in my own personal practice, it's the way that I try to approach things.
Right. Yeah. There's certainly a reality to the unexplainable. You know, if there wasn't some sort of reality to it, then we wouldn't be trying to explain it. I think if you want to, put it quickly, but, you know, it's a lot more, there's symbolism in the greater scope and the given syntax of the situations, because symbolism obviously is not just something written down or conveyed through artistic means. It's essentially how, you know, when you get into things like archetypes and mimetics, it's kind of the building blocks of the imagination process, which is in and of itself a really nuanced adaptation mechanism, essentially.
Yeah.
So,
that's interesting, because that goes back to that connection, right, between things like horror and the esoteric, and you're talking about archetypes and stuff like that. I mean, that was Jung's thing, right? And when Jung came up with it, everyone's like, you're a quack, you know, kind of go away, and we'll do things the way that Freud likes to do them, because he's very scientific and logical, and you're talking about airy fairy stories that no one cares about. But as we see now, I think there's a big resurgence in Jungian thought.
Yeah, well, I think it's we've come to a point in our culture at this point, especially these days, where I don't, you know, this actually. So I did prepare a little bit. I don't have like a full dissertation out or anything, but I certainly, whenever I go on a show, I think a little bit about. Just the general topics that I feel like would be good to touch on. And, you know, lately, and also just what I've been thinking about in my life is usually part of the inspiration there. And, you know, this whole, this dichotomy that we're in today that has really solidified over the years, and I feel like is perhaps more solidified than, more so solidified than most other times. There might be other times throughout history you could argue, but this weird good and evil perspective, and how it symbolically it's become mishmashed in some counterintuitive ways. Like you look at, you know, so especially in the Abrahamic traditions, like God often equals this this objectivity and therefore authority, and like a focus on the collective, and that's good. And then you have Satan, which is subjective, and it has this focus on the self, and that's a rebellion towards the collective inherently, and that's bad. And I'm not trying to argue that good and evil are irrelevant, because I'm sure that's something we'll probably get into
for sure
in the conversation. Yeah. But this whole idea that objective, and also in materialist science today, there seems to be this really huge emphasis on objective being real and subjective being fake for some reason. Like the subjective is just purely some sort of derivative, and it's just some sort of imaginative process that doesn't really amount to anything. It's just static on a television screen. And it's just it's so convoluted these days. I don't even know how we got to this point, but that really brings us to a crux that I feel like we've been moving towards for a while now. And it's just this idea that, you know, I guess it made more sense if you look at it on an evolutionary scale. Obviously, like, a focus on the collective would be extremely advantageous, and it still is today. But with the advents of modern society that we have, there's become more and more of an emphasis on the self inherently, in terms of the adaptation process, you could say. Because, you know, I mean, it's a basic point, but when you extrapolate it further, there's a lot of implications. Because, you know, today obviously we're not going and hunting and looking for our food and these things. We have a very different society and culture, and this allows us, on, you know, glass half full, it allows us to be able to, like, express our individuality. But glass half empty, we are in some sense forced to as well. And a lot of people don't know how to do that. And sometimes that can be detrimental if you don't know how to do that. You kind of open up Pandora's box a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's where things get kind of Lovecraftian. So
for sure. Yeah, I'm glad that this is what you wanted to talk about. Because this week I'm actually tackling Zoroastrianism, this week and next week. Oh, and the heavy dualistic idea of good versus evil is kind of at the core of Zoroastrian cosmology, you know? Like, there must be a good god that does the good stuff, and therefore there must be a bad god that does the bad stuff. And obviously that's heavily influenced Abrahamic traditions and a lot of Western thought, really, in general. So it's the perfect topic to dive into. And myself, as kind of a slightly more, we'll say, maybe Buddhist-inspired and a little bit of a Advaita inspiration, I'm less prone to focus so much on there actually being good or evil, but I understand kind of the need for that kind of thing. I would say, even in particular in modern culture, and I like the way that you phrased it, where things kind of seem to be changing towards this focus. Like, there's a resurgence of the subjective, but there's still a heavy focus on an objective reality, because, you know, now that we just kind of all live in tight groups, it seems like you have to force this narrative of an objective reality in order for a tight-knit community to continue to survive. And you know, were we still, you know, say 2,000, 5,000 years ago, where it's just like a group of a dozen people or 50 people even, you wouldn't need that so much, possibly. Or maybe you do. Maybe it's the opposite. But it feels like now that there's, you know, thousands or millions of people living in one space, you have to force an objective narrative, or else it just kind of falls apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as a bit of like an asterisk, like an additional note to the conversation of the evolutionary scale and the perception of the collective juxtaposed with the self, I have read before in some different, like, it's a recurring theme in some like Masonic and like Rosicrucian philosophy. And I'm sure that you could find similar sentiment among the Hindu with the yuga cycles, but I'm not so well versed in that. But this idea of the human evolutionary curve having being like indicative of the precession of the equinox, you know, the sun's relationship to the earth. And that obviously in some way we don't fully understand the implications of it, but inevitably in some way that is going to affect human consciousness. And the consistent esoteric implication there is that the axial tilt actually had something to do with the initial perspective of the collective eventually moving more and more towards the self. So
yeah, I've actually noticed something. I'm not into astrology too much. I mean, I love stargazing and things like that, but in terms of following horoscopes and things, I'm not too into it. I do appreciate things like tarot and the I Ching though, because they seem a little more open to interpretation than just kind of watching the way constellations move. And part of the issue that I have with at least Western astrology is kind of that it's stuck on a system that was true, you know, say during the Bronze Age or earlier when it was created, and not so much true now because the positions of the stars and the constellations have changed because of things like precession. And the Western system hasn't really accounted for that. And I don't think that's true if you look at like Mayan astrology or people that use the Vedic systems. But in terms of, you know, the horoscope that you'd find on like, you know, the Sunday paper, it seems like if there were some influence of heavenly bodies on us and things around us, and I believe that is the case, at least in some extent, then it seems like it's kind of a little off if we're not charting the constellations properly according to their actual position. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And those are really important points that more astrology enthusiasts should listen to, because I have interest in astrology insofar as the historical and anthropological and even the esoteric extents in general, like how the symbolism is used so sprinkled all throughout Western esotericism. And I mean, since astrology in some form or another is seen across the globe, that's another interesting point, is where I would essentially agree with you for sure that there's something to it. Like at the very least, you could say the science as we know it will fully back it up, that the Earth's relationship to the sun has a huge impact on us. So that in and of itself is essentially what is being charted with the precession of the equinox. And the way I see it is you don't even need, and I don't even necessarily think that there are any sort of energies affecting the Earth from these different planets, although there could be, but it seems to me it was more so of that these planets were they were used as kind of place markers to help identify the Earth's actual distance to the sun.
Makes sense. Yeah,
so I think people, you know, New Age it up a little too much these days. Yeah.
No, I agree. I agree.
But there is interesting value to that. Especially, you know, me growing up in Alaska, the lack of sunlight, I could tell you it's a totally different environment. So let's see. Thinking about this good and evil thing, how the subjective is considered so derivative today that it is barely given much credit, it seems. I don't think that good and evil do exist on an objective level. I think that is pretty well, demonstrable at this point. Mm-hmm. But just because it is subjective doesn't mean that you throw it out the window. And there does seem to be this sort of, you know, it seems like the classic good guy, bad guy dichotomy is really just some sort of exoteric explanation of the alchemical process, because it seems to me like when you, look at Christianity, for example, and you parse through the history of it as it's evolved over all these centuries, it seems that, well, it's very evident that this whole idea of hell and Satan as we know it today is a weird, it just kind of, it was like a snowball effect, but, you know, that came probably through mostly translations. Like I'm not a linguist, but I could tell you that there are cases to be made by linguists that the relevance of like translation, like between lesser demons and an arch demon, just some of that gets mishmashed in translation, it seems. And how much Satan or like an arch nemesis is even referenced in the Bible is debatable. It's not non-existent, but it doesn't seem to be the huge focus that it definitely, without a question, was not the huge focus that it is today in this dichotomy that's been created.
Let me interrupt it for a second. It's really funny that you mentioned this particular example, mm-hmm. because I actually have recorded, I haven't released it yet, but I did record an episode on number one, why Lucifer is not Satan, and right. number two, why there is no devil in the Bible.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
And you're right. Part of it is a mistranslation, right? Because, for example, the term Lucifer only shows up in the Old Testament one time. Okay. And it's not in reference to any entity. It is literally referencing Venus. And it's an allegory towards the king of Babylon at the time. So, you know, things like that get lost in translation when you pick the word that kind of pushes your agenda a little further, right? So when it gets translated into Greek and they see this term that means morning star in the Old Testament, they say, oh yeah, morning star, like in our language, that's Lucifer. And then as the idea of good and evil progress, you know, after Jesus' death, for example, when the early church forms, you kind of have to find things to prove your point of view, right? And so you say, well, yeah, here in this text, it says Lucifer. Lucifer is the devil. And everyone's like, well, yeah, that makes sense because none of us speak Greek. So sure, we'll go with that, right? Like this guy knows. He studied the Bible his whole life. And yeah. that kind of goes to the main issue that I always have with dogmatic approaches to religion is that, you know, you lose your authority to think, right? And you allow others to think for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that the more you look at the Bible, I haven't read the whole thing. It'd be hard-pressed to find someone who has read the whole thing. But I've definitely picked through, and there are certain texts that I gravitate towards because of their poignance and also because of the plethora of commentary other like actual scholars have made on them, like the Book of Job and, you know, the story of Cain and Abel, especially those two, because of this whole relationship that we're looking at with good and evil and how it doesn't even quite line up to what you would consider modern Christianity today. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like I said, right before, it seems like in the Book of Job, which is something that Gautier was really trying to emphasize with his rendition of Faust, that God and Satan don't even seem to be so much in opposition with each other. And it's more of Satan being used as this alchemical solvent of sorts. And, you know, I think it's a bit too reductionist to say that they work together, but Jung in his book Answer to Job, which is it's only like 150 pages or something like that, but it's so dense, it's impressive and a lot to get through, but in a good way. And I believe that Jung actually said, I'm like 99% sure, I think it's in the foreword of this copy I have, that of all the texts that he wrote throughout his career, Answer to Job would be the only one that he didn't have any corrections to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and it's a very Gnostic sort of text where it's like a Gnostic Christian would be the best way to encapsulate it, because throughout it, he is trying to dissect this idea of Yahweh as the antinomy, which is the opposites in totality. Mm-hmm. And also how that requires some sort of projection process of Yahweh. Whereas Jung is always talking about people's projection process being like the vessel for these concepts of gods and these metaphysical ideas, he in the answer to Job is saying that from his best guess, like from just how the text reads, Yahweh is going through the same type of almost existential crisis as Job is, as there's this communication process unfolding. Because at times Yahweh seems frustrated and even petulant and essentially very Zeus-like.
Yeah.
And you could find that, obviously, that's nothing new. You could find that all throughout the Old Testament. And it seems like the New Testament was Christians kind of trying to clean house a little bit. And like, all right, well, he's not that bad. I mean, Yahweh is rough. He is brutal. But he can also be cool at times. So these are two things that I feel like are kind of cruxes of the conversation here, is that if you just want to take it in the terms of like the Western symbolism, God is imperfect, and it's important to have some sort of sympathy for the devil. Two things that I would be tortured and hanged for.
No, but you're right, actually. And I find that allegory interesting. I haven't read Answer to Job in a long, long time, so I can't comment on it. But the way that you're explaining on it does kind of lead credence to this argument that the God in the Old Testament is the Zoroastrian Ahriman, right? So in Zoroastrianism, you have these two deities. You have Ahura Mazda, who's the good god, and his twin brother is Ahriman, right? And Ahriman's kind of like deformed, right? And so as a result, like he does evil things, but like he's not necessarily evil, right? He's just like he's very selfish and self-centered, whereas Ahura Mazda like wants the world to be in peace, right? And like everyone live according to nature and this, that, and the other. And Ahriman doesn't want that, right? Like he wants to be in control, kind of like the demiurge for the Gnostics. And the interesting thing about that is, and so there's been many a paper written that Ahriman is Yahweh, right? But the interesting thing about that philosophy that I think is often overlooked is that there is kind of this reference to the Yugas, because of course the Zoroastrians come from Persia, and so they're, you know, in the European culture, and a lot of the mythology does have some basis with what you would find in India and other places. Mm-hmm. And they switch places. So I think it's like every 3,000 years, one of these guys is ruling the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you have this era of time where like things are really tough for people because Ahriman's in place and he controls everything, and everything's about, you know, praising Ahriman and this, that, and the other. And then there's a battle and they switch places and Ahura Mazda takes over. And then you have like a golden age, right, where everyone lives in peace and happiness. And I find that whole concept really fascinating. And a really cool take on what people normally think of as the Yugas, right?
Yeah, very fascinating indeed. Yeah, because that leads me to another point that I'd been thinking about all this time, and because here's the thing: is I don't identify as Christian. If anything, I guess you could call me some sort of like hermeticist. I don't really ascribe to anything concretely, like one thing in particular. But so there's always that, what you were raised with always has that lingering kind of effect for you. And plus I have family members still, so I still have to, I'm always trying to, play devil's advocate because you could say that I certainly have more Gnostic leanings, where I, you know, clearly, talking about, Yahweh being petulant. but I definitely, I do appreciate the esoteric Christianity. The exoteric versions these days frustrate me, to say the least.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the tradition. And I think it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater a little bit to say that Yahweh is full blown evil, which is a point that, you were describing how it was more, you were making that point as well, essentially. And
yeah, it's kind of like when you look at yin yang, right? Like there's a little bit of darkness and the light and a little bit of light in the darkness.
Exactly. It's a very big point. Yeah. Like they did that for a reason. So we start talking about the demiurge and how imperfect is Yahweh really, but then it doesn't really, you could flip the symbolism on its head, but it doesn't explain the subjective day-to-day human question of what is good and evil and how much does it really affect us?
Absolutely.
Because, yeah. Like one way or the other, you have one good and one bad, like you can't seem to get around it. And it, it seems to be, it's very important that we have this, this cultural agreement that happens. And I think that it, this is something else that, plays into the conversation is, thermodynamics and chaos theory, which, has a lot of value for a lot of different reasons in this conversation. Like, first of all, just the fact that psychology, Freud and Jung were both heavily inspired by, the psychological implications that things like thermodynamics might have. And then that's how Jung got on this whole trip about the Gnostics and the alchemists, because he was looking at light and dark and he was like, wow, okay, these are like allegories for physics of the mind.
Yeah. Yep.
That rings true. And I think that good and evil, while are subjective in the sense of our explanations of them to the T, they are reminiscent of laws of physics, essentially laws of nature, because it's an evolutionary agreement that we have between us all, where if you do a certain part to make sure that you don't ruin other people's chance, then you'll generally have your chance as well. And these things change over time, and it kind of goes back to the motif of what we're talking about with the switch from the collective more to the subjective, because in today's society, in the past, you could focus on the collective and everybody would be fine. But in today's society, since there's naturally more of a focus on the self bottoms out, and then you have a neurotic deviant or psychopath. These people bottom out and they're still perfectly functioning for all intents and purposes in society, and that's very bad. That wouldn't have happened thousands of years ago. They would have, for better or worse, probably thrown that person off a cliff or something, Sparta style.
Sure. Well, and and there are still cultures, I think particularly in Africa and in the Amazon, where the biggest punishment you can get, it's just being ostracized from the tribe, right? Because the mentality is so collective that if you're on your own, you're just guaranteed death, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This whole good and evil thing in the long run, it makes sense. Just because it's subjective, like I said, doesn't make it irrelevant. And I think, we have to take certain things into perspective. Like clearly, it's it's not good to harm a child, like, under any circumstances.
Right.
So we know that. So we can't call that good in today's common society. So that's not what a good person would do. So there has to be some sort of category that is not good and that is evil. But we all like Aristotle and we like a lot of Greek philosophers. Well, most of those guys were diddling kids. Like,
it was, yes.
It was part of their culture. Were those guys evil? If they were in today's society, yes, they would be. And I still think that that is not a good, quote unquote, trait of a person. But also, it's kind of the evolutionary, like, psychological thermodynamics of the situation. Like, I'm not what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I'm not making an argument for it, but there's just the evolutionary thing. People lived, like, they didn't even live as long, and there's all sorts of different things. And but all I'm trying to say is I'm not going to throw out all of Greek philosophy because of that. So there has to be, we have to understand that there's some sort of subjective curve to it all, but that doesn't make it irrelevant, clearly. And people get wrapped up in their ideas of people get really, really wrapped up in deifying these concepts, and it convolutes things.
I think part of the issue is that when people look at things like morality and ethics, they take it that it's like a universal thing, right? So no matter where in the universe you go, this exact thing is wrong. But even here, within specific circumstances, that thing might not necessarily be considered wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, in the United States, in many states, if somebody comes on your property, legally, you're allowed to shoot them, mm-hmm. right? In some countries, that's preposterous, right? That you would have that ability, right? Or same thing if you kill somebody, right? If you kill somebody, we deem that as wrong. But what if it's like self-preservation, right? What if this person broke into your house and was going to kill your wife or your kids, right? In that case, then you're like, okay, well, in that case, it's okay to kill the person. Well, which is it? Is murder okay or is it not okay?
Right.
You see what I mean? So there's always these nuances. And when you think of ethics and morality, you know, I always get the comments when I talk about the stuff that, oh, well, you're a moral relativist, so, like, everything's cool by you. And that's not what I'm saying at all, right? No. You need to look at these things in terms of the culture that you're looking at, right? And so here, one thing is okay, and we all agree that that's okay. But we also need to respect the fact that, you know, in China or Russia or South Africa or Spain or somewhere else, that thing is not seen as okay, right? So if we go to France, right, and we do whatever, I don't know, we carry a gun, okay? In the U.S., you can carry a gun in many states, right, if you have a concealed weapons permit. Mm-hmm. You go to France and you have your gun on you, they'll arrest you, right? You go to Japan, if you have it in your house, they'll arrest you because it's illegal to own a firearm. You know what I mean? So, like, you can't be like, oh, well, yeah, back home, I can have my gun in my pocket. Well, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, and 100%. And, you know, to the people who would consider that moral relativism, it really isn't. It's what we've been talking about this whole time, where the positive and negative have this alchemical transmutation dance that's going on. And that's what the yin and yang is showing. Is so perfect in its simplicity, where you have to understand that there's the ebb and flow, and that these things have there's a core relevance to it, but it's going to change in the given cultures, like you said. I don't know if there's a very good segue for this, but it's on the same topic, and this is definitely as well something that I wanted to bring up, where people are trying to deify these concepts of good and evil and positive and negative. And, you know, it really got me thinking, like, so if if thermodynamics is playing a role in this as like a path of least resistance evolutionarily in the psyche, then what is like, so what is God here? Like, let's just talk a little bit of philosophy for fun.
Oh yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. So, because when you look at like Yahweh specifically, it's a very humanized quality. All the gods have humanized qualities, and that's the whole thing to it. But you ask like the average person today that's open-minded but not too dogmatic, they tend to give you this like animist sort of mindset where God is like the living, breathing universe in and of itself. And I think that is a nice metaphor. I like that. But the more I've thought about it recently, contemplating this, that doesn't seem to be like what the traditional definition of a god is. Mm-hmm. A god is this sort of a confluence of these like thermodynamic laws of nature and how they become humanized when they interact with the subjective experience, so to speak. But what's behind that? You know, because even Dante and the Divine Comedy, and I mean, even Christianity itself, that God is residing in heaven. So there's something beyond God. And the idea of omnipotence was what really got me here. And it's the idea that, you know, omnipotence being almighty, you have power over everything. But I don't really, I don't think that there is like a sentient conscious thing out there that has power over the laws of the universe. And that doesn't seem to be what, unless you're really caught up in your dogma, no disrespect, but that doesn't seem to be what most people think of as God today, if they want to use that term. But that's what God is throughout all of religions. It's something that has the power. It has the omnipotence, but what most people are really striking at these days is a term that I didn't know was a thing until recently, but it's, let's see, how do you pronounce it? Metapotence, like metapotence. This, okay. Instead of having power over the law, you are the law.
Right.
And that's really what, I think that at this point, scientifically in the archetypal process, we can demystify a lot of the talk about gods, but we can't strip away. Like, you know, I listened to your episode on, you know, faith, belief, and gnosis. And I would say at this point that, which was very good, by the way.
Thanks.
I don't think that I wouldn't say that I believe in any gods, but I do have faith in them because I understand that they are not these humanized personifications that's the allegory part of it. But what I do know is that there are transpersonal embodiments of laws of physics that do have impact on our subjective experiences in radical ways that we could still barely fathom. You know, it's the kind of chaos magician idea of things where, like, you know, Ares, the god of war, is this transpersonal symbolic embodiment of not only all war throughout history, but the emotions that lead to war. And in that way, whether or not there is any sentient god up there, the idea of like Ares lives through all of that. And I think that really is, that's like the true definition of these things. They're not particularly sentient, and they don't have omnipotence. There's no omnipotence. Otherwise things would not have this slow, like natural law effect. Like clearly there's no alchemist at the lab bench in heaven tinkering with things. Yeah.
It's yeah. There's a lot to what you just said, man. And I like all of it. I think one thing that I find interesting is this idea of like God creates man creates God, right? Mm-hmm. And there's different interpretations of that idea in different philosophies. So for the Gnostics, you would have a demiurge who created the material universe, but then you have the God above God, right? And mm-hmm. and It could be any names like Abraxas, Debethos, whatever,
Right.
any of these names. But there is something higher than the God that created this. And that God has a lot of power because he created this stuff out of the little piece of the one true God that he emerged from. But he's not, he doesn't have complete power, right? That's up to the one above God. And the thing is that the God above God doesn't, which being the true God, by the way, doesn't really care about like day-to-day operations, right? Right. And I think in many ways that must be a lot of the Eastern inspiration for Gnosticism, because you have similar ideas within like Hinduism, for example, right? And there's a good argument to be made that Hinduism is not a religion, it's a philosophy, it's a cultural way of life. But if you look at the God aspects of it, you know, most people think of it as a polytheistic religion. But really, there's only one God, right? It's Brahman. And then all the other ones are just different manifestations of right. that one entity, right? So you have a God for creation, a God for death, a God for the sky, a God for the earth. And it's not that they are separate entities, but ultimately they kind of all get their power from, again, the God above God, right? From Brahman. And I find that idea much more interesting. Yes. And I think it's... I think the problem is that people don't like to think that their God is fallible or doesn't have ultimate authority or can do wrong, right? People want to believe in a perfect being, and they always want to have a savior that, you know, that's why you get doomsday predictions, you know, twice a year now.
Right.
Now we're recording this on the 18th, so this episode may never come out, right? Because people are saying the world ends on the 21st now. And you know, and this has been going on for how many, I mean, we know for a fact 2000 years, right? In Christian tradition. But
oh, yeah.
But there's been doomsday predictions for 10,000 years. And the world never ends, right? It just constantly changes and evolves. Mm-hmm. And I think that is kind of, you know, I like to really simplify things, right? When I find a belief system, I'm like, whoa, that's let me think about this, right? Because there's some truth in here. And always I end up getting down to the core, and it always arrives at the same place, where like even the most fantastical story that you can come up in any religious text or anything else, like through an oral tradition, it always comes down to just like everyday experience, right?
Yeah.
And it's just so veiled in beautiful language sometimes, in beautiful images, that people are like, oh yeah, it's not about, you know, let me not be a glutton, right? And whatever. They take that as like the ritual, right? So they're like, oh, I can't be a glutton, so like I'm gonna fast for 6 days out of the week. That's what God wants. Like, it's not what God wants. All it's saying is, like, be a good human being, right? Like, be a decent human being. Don't destroy the environment around you, because then you have nowhere to live. You know, thank the animals for the fact that they allow you to kill them so you can eat them. You know, like, just be nice to each other. Be cool with each other. What, isn't that a quote from Bill and Ted? Be excellent to each other. Like, that's what it boils down to. You know what I mean? Just like, be excellent to each other. And don't overeat. Don't just sit on your couch and watch TV all day. You know, like, go enjoy nature. You know, eat and then you're full, quit eating. You want to do psychedelics? Do some psychedelics. You want to pray? You want to read? Do whatever you want. I think even Alan Watts kind of, he made fun of Crowley one time. He didn't mention Crowley by name, but you know, that was Crowley's thing, right? Like, do what thou wilt. And without mentioning Crowley, Watts said something to the effect of like, you know, people talk about do what thou wilt all the time. You know, Buddhist monks have been saying it for 3,000 years. Taoist missionaries have been saying it for 5,000 years. This is just like a common sense thing. You right. should be able to do what you want, right? As long as you're not hurting others in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That articulated well in the the beautiful story, the beautiful allegory that's become very exoterically convoluted these days with the whole bite of the apple in the garden, and how knowing thyself is inherently demonic and evil and shameful. But also, all this in mind, it is obviously very important to have some sort of Platonic ideals. You don't want to be a nihilist or a moral relativist. You do want to have some lines in the sand that you draw, so sure. to speak. And I think you just to cherry on top for listeners especially, like that. I think people want to see they want to have like a perfect God as that ideal, some sort of. But you articulated it well a bit earlier, people's desire for it. But that's not really what the ideal is, because, some priests are pedophiles. I mean, that's not God in of itself. Yeah. But that's like sometimes, God can be a very good thing, but sometimes your dedication to God can lead to some horrifying things. And just like I've met and I... most people have at this point met the regular LaVey style Satanist in their everyday life, and they're great people most of the time. Some of them can be a little narcissistic, but they're pretty much just like rebellious, eccentric atheists.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so yeah, that's just goes to show that it's the alchemical solvent, stripping the impurities, it's good to do, and it's good to know how to use those things. But you also, to use the basic, a thermodynamic-esque metaphor, you could use heat to purify things, but you could also burn the shit out of what you're trying to extract to right. begin with, and ruin the whole thing.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's about not taking it too seriously, man. I watched a great document. Well, I don't want to say great. It was good. a documentary about the Pastafarians. Are you familiar?
Oh, is that Spaghetti Monster?
Yeah.
I know a little bit.
Yeah, so the documentary is called I, Pastafari. And it basically just like kind of shows you what Pastafarians believe in. And it's kind of a joke. Like, it started as a joke religion, right? They do have a sacred text that is basically like rewriting parts of the Bible in comedic fashion. But ultimately, it's a religion set up for people that don't believe in religion, or that find religion kind of preposterous in the over eccentricity of it, right? And right. So they try to convey this message in a religious way. Right. So they have mass on Sunday. Right. One of their things is like their priests have to wear pirate regalia, like full pirate regalia.
And I didn't realize it was that extensive.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And there's like 3 million people that identify as Pastafarian, apparently, worldwide. So it kind of goes through their beliefs kind of and kind of the schism that happened. There's some people that wear a colander on their head now, instead of their pirate regalia. But wow. But it's interesting in the sense that it's similar to what the Church of Satan does and right. and other similar things like what's the one that put up that Baphomet statue? I can't remember. It wasn't Church of Satan, but it's like an offshoot group, something of Satan.
Oh, what, the Temple of Set, maybe?
Maybe it was the Temple of Set. And
founded by... LaVey's right-hand man who branched off, Michael Aquino, and there's all sorts of conspiracy theories about him.
LaVey's daughter was in that too for a little while.
Yeah.
She's got her own thing now.
Right, and for anyone who doesn't know, that the Temple of Set was formed because of LaVey's atheism, essentially. The Seti wanted to take the black magic much more seriously.
Which is funny, right? That LaVey creates basically a religion for atheists, And then you have an offshoot group that says, well, no, like, we really want to worship Satan.
So, yeah, it's very curious.
Right. But that's how it happens, though. Right. You create the system and then people take it too literal. Mm-hmm. And so you create the deity. Right. God creates man. Man creates God.
Yeah. This is something I just have to add for fun here. I'm not sure. It's just kind of like an addition to the consideration of religion in this like postmodern sort of era we have. But when I was looking into like just different chaos magic stuff, I came across, I had no idea this was a thing. I'm not trying to throw shade, but it seems just preposterous to me. I'm sure you're familiar with the community of all sorts of people that are interested in the My Little Pony cartoons.
Yes, the bronies.
Yeah, and they call them bronies and stuff, like grown men. Yeah, well, apparently, not joking, anyone could Google this, and they even did some, like, observational, like, analytical studies about this, about the community. But there was, like, internet communities that I believe still exist where people started, these bronies that they call them, started incorporating chaos magic into their ideas about the My Little Pony cartoon, and actually created forums about how to summon your own My Little Pony tulpas. Seriously.
That's amazing. You know, right? That's so funny. I didn't know that, but I did know that there were like tulpa communities on Reddit where they get together, create these things.
I could be wrong, but I'm quite certain that the My Little Pony Tulpa community was like the first one, if not the first big one.
I believe it.
Yeah. So the religious or mystical train of thought in today's postmodern society has taken on some interesting, it's taken on some interesting faces. I don't know how much more time you have, you want to talk about, but I got some more time, and I figured if there was anything else at the end, we could talk about UFOs a little bit too, since that keeps coming up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got time, man. You, whatever you want. It's your show. It's your show tonight.
Cool. Well, hey, I appreciate that, man. So it really triggered my memory talking about mystical train of thought in this society. UFOs is, and ufology is, a very curious thing. Now, I want to make a disclaimer, because I'm going to take some jabs here, but it's not any personal jabs. I'm just asking skeptical questions, and I want anybody who is really staunchly on the like gung-ho disclosure ufology to the max side of the fence, I'm with you. Like, I'm not saying that these things don't exist. I'm not the asshole that's telling you that you're insane or anything. I've seen some UFOs. I've never seen little beings, but I've seen some crazy stuff, and I know that there's some unexplainable stuff out there. But we have to ask some serious questions here. Now that there's it seems to ebb and flow. It never seems to quite get anywhere, the interest in ufology, but it seems to be really building towards something right now. And you know, at its best, I think that ufology, in this more like overarching Fortean sense, I think it's very important to be investigating these things. But at the same time, it's also important to realize that these things, like ufology itself, it does take on this sort of quasi-religious quality to it.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of The Alchemical Mind. I want to thank Anthony for joining me on this discussion of the nature of good and evil. If you want to check out the ufology discussion, head on over to the Patreon, patreon.com/TheAlchemicalMind, and you can listen to that bonus episode at any level, starting at $1 a month and up. And that's going to be it for this one. I hope you enjoyed it. I have many more guests coming up, many more fantastic episodes coming up. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this kind of serves as sort of an introduction to some of the things that I'll be diving into as we dive into Zoroastrianism, a terrific religion, very influential in the way that Western culture has kind of tweaked and developed religion and philosophy over the last several thousand years. So if you want to get in touch, Twitter's the best place, at Mind Alchemical. Email is Martin at the Alchemical Mind. Check out the website, thealchemicalmind.com. And the Discord, there's a link in the website for the Discord. So come join us there and have some interesting discussions. That will be it for this one. Thank you for listening. And as always, remember that you are it.